America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is The Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And it's a great week because this week we are going to be celebrating Constitution Day. That's right, September 17th is the anniversary of the signing of the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution of the United States, as much as anything, is what makes this the greatest nation on God's green earth. People who deny that, who deny American exceptionalism, have to come face to face with what Al Gore might call an inconvenient truth. And that inconvenient truth is this. The United States of America and our revolution represent the only major revolution in all of human history that's been unequivocally successful. Why? Well, because we've had the same system of government, the same founding charter with very minor changes for going on 230 years. How did that happen? That happened through a combination of confrontation and compromise and maybe a little bit of providential protection. Actually, maybe a lot of it. It's what we could call the miracle of the Constitution. An amazing story involving amazing personalities. And we tell that story in this very special broadcast of The Michael Medved Show. And of course, there are millions of Americans who recognize the importance of the Constitution, but there are questions about it. How did it come about? How did all of that happen? And why is it so different from the experience of every other nation? We're going to go into the story, the remarkable story of the series of coincidences. Some people might say the consistent evidence of providence in the direction of those folks who got together and drafted America's founding charter. Now, first of all, the idea that the American Revolution is different from every other revolution. If you go back in all of human history, sure, in the first century BC, there was a big revolution in Rome. The gladiator Spartacus led this sweeping slave revolt against the Roman Republic. He had some stunning victories, but it ended up with 6,000 crucifixions along the Appian Way. And a slave rebellion in Haiti, 1,900 years later, also did brilliantly. It ended French rule on the Caribbean island, but it produced chaotic conditions and a long series of failed oppressive governments, and right now the worst living conditions in the Western Hemisphere. In Europe, the French Revolution got rid of the old regime, cut off the head of King Louis, and guess what? They emphasized liberty, equality, and fraternity. And that experiment lasted barely a decade before yielding to Napoleon's dictatorship. Then he became emperor. And the Napoleonic Wars cost some of 4 million casualties throughout Europe. Do I need to talk about the Russian Revolution and Stalin, or the Chinese Revolution and Mao, or the many revolutions in Latin America that got rid of Spanish and Portuguese rule, but then led to a series of dysfunctional governments? What's so special about America, even compared to Britain, which had its own revolution about 100 years before ours? And yes, there were Puritans fighting against royalists who supported King Charles and the Stuart monarchy, and King Charles got his head cut off, and there was a bloody British Revolution. But then Oliver Cromwell got installed as Lord Protector, and then after he died, the old Stuart kings came back. Not a successful revolution. That was very, very different in the United States. We had a Revolutionary War, and the Revolutionary War ran from 1775 in April all the way through 1783 before they had a peace treaty and some recognition of American independence by the mother country. And then between 1783 and 1787, it looked like we might go the way of other revolutions. Why? Well, because basically we had a system of government that was in place that was largely dysfunctional. And I know there are some people who defend it, but you can't really defend it if you see what was happening and you see what people were observing at the time. And then we had a constitutional convention which produced this remarkable document, which after a very, very difficult fight got adopted. And we've had a stable, functioning, extraordinarily successful government ever since. So how did that happen? What's fascinating to me is that even people who normally are not associated as being deeply, deeply religious saw that constitutional convention as a work of the Almighty. For instance, James Madison, who later became the fourth president of the United States, is called the father of the Constitution because he played such a prominent role at the Constitutional Convention. He actually took notes so that we know what all the debates were and what was going on and who said what to whom. He wrote to his friend Thomas Jefferson, who was away in Paris as the minister to France, that he found it, quote, impossible to consider the degree of concord which ultimately prevailed as less than a miracle. George Washington, who was president of the Constitutional Convention, he presided over it, said almost nothing. But his presence was so important because he had such prestige, having been the victorious general in the war. He said and wrote on February 7, 1788, it seems to me then little short of a miracle, that's what he wrote to Lafayette, that delegates from so many different states, which states, you know, are also different from each other, in their manners, circumstances, and prejudices, should unite in forming a system of national government so little liable to well-found objections. Okay, so how did they do it? What makes it most remarkable is that when they got together, it wasn't even called in Philadelphia a constitutional convention. The Congress that authorized the gathering was operating under the old Articles of Confederation that had linked the states in a flimsy, quote, league of friendship with each other since February of 1781 at the very end, tail end of the Revolutionary War. They had adopted the Articles of Confederation. They hadn't really worked, but they did not authorize in the Confederation Congress for a whole new charter for a powerful new national government. The resolution they passed, sanctioning a federal convention, said that the convention would meet, quote, for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation, not replacing them. They weren't supposed to junk those articles entirely. In fact, Martin Van Buren, who was the eighth president of the United States, and he was one of the leading lawyers of his age, which was a later age, he looked back on the work of the Philadelphia Convention and he described it as an heroic and lawless act. Why lawless? Because they gathered there and they weren't supposed to just replace the articles and draw a whole new scheme of government. But they recognized that that was what America needed. Why? Because of the impotence and ineffectiveness of Congress during the Revolutionary War and for 6 years after the fighting ended. The Articles of Confederation was arranged this way. All of the 13 states, the 13 original colonies, had a single congressional vote. So mighty Virginia, which had almost a fourth of the total population of the whole country, had no more weight than sparsely settled Georgia, despite 20 times the population. Each state legislature got to choose two delegates to the old Confederation Congress, and if those two delegates split over any issue, their state got to count no vote at all. And the delegates themselves were often frustrated because they were only allowed to serve one-year terms, with a prohibition on serving more than 3 years of six. Now, I know that sounds great to people who are in favor of term limits, but at the time, it meant that people did not want to serve in the Congress because you had to travel, it was expensive, and oh yes, expensive, they didn't get paid by the federal government. They had to get paid by some of the individual states, and some of the times the states had no money, and they didn't even pay the people who were going to Congress. The only empowered body of the national government, which was the Congress, they had no president, they had no executive branch, they often didn't even have a quorum, which required both delegates of at least seven states to be present. And on top of all of that, they could approve nothing, without having nine of the 13 states approving it. So this is problematic. In 1783, a dangerous mutiny in Philadelphia chased the delegates from the continent's largest city. They didn't even have a set capital that they went to under the Articles of Confederation. They moved to Annapolis, Maryland, to Trenton, New Jersey, to New York. Oliver Ellsworth, who was a delegate from Connecticut to the Congress, said that it will soon be of very little consequence where Congress go. He said, if they are not made respectable as well as responsible, which can never be done without giving them a power to perform engagements as well as to make them. In other words, to live up to what they were talking about. So how did that change come about? That's part of the story in this special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, The Miracle of the Constitution. The song Yankee Doodle, of course, inspired the American troops in what they viewed rightly as their miraculous victory over the British and the winning of American independence in the Revolution. But then the question was, you've won the war, but how do you win the peace? How do you create a stable, functioning central government? That's the question behind this very special broadcast called The Miracle of the Constitution. How'd it happen? How'd they do it? What were the obstacles they encountered and how'd they overcome them? Well, the obstacle that they encountered right after the Revolution was the fact that the Articles of Confederation simply didn't work. The states were sovereign. The federal government, the Continental Congress, which became the Confederation Congress, had very, very limited power. One of the problems with that was there was no executive. There was no functioning president. There was no functioning head of the army, or there were committees of Congress to see to defense or relations with foreign nations, but no one whose exclusive job that was. And part of the difficulty is there were a great number of foreign threats. And you say, well, what threats could there possibly be to America? We were protected by the big ocean from Britain. But don't forget, the British were empowered up in Canada. And there were still British troops there. And there were still problems and challenges with Indians. Now, the British troops in Canada were making trouble by working with a bunch of potential rebels against the central government down in Vermont. Now, this is all extraordinarily complicated. It's very, very amusing, actually. Ethan Allen, who was one of the heroes with his Green Mountain Boys of the Revolutionary War, particularly the Battle of Ticonderoga, Ethan Allen and his buddies declared an independent republic of Vermont because they couldn't get themselves admitted to the Union. Now, why couldn't they get admitted to the Union and to the Articles of Confederation? The answer is because both New Hampshire and New York claimed the territory of Vermont, and Congress couldn't make up its mind and couldn't decide. So meanwhile, the British are scheming to say, hey, you can have your independent Republic of Vermont join us up in Canada. Now, that would have put a British division right between New England and the Middle Atlantic states. It would have crippled the new nation. There were also problems with these new territories of Tennessee and Kentucky. Over 100,000 Americans right after the Revolution had spilled into that area. And they wanted to be two new states, but the Spanish claimed it. The Spanish took over the Louisiana, what later became the Louisiana Purchase. They took it over from the French. They were also in Florida. They were conspiring with an American general, secretly bribing him. His name was James Wilkinson, who was supposed to lead all these folks in Tennessee, his neighbors, to becoming part of Spain. So these were real threats that the deeply concerned patriotic Americans wanted to see the success of the new country. The other problems were economic because there were each state had its own currency. Each state had its own money system. They didn't trust each other. They didn't cooperate with each other. They had tariffs not only against foreign imports, but often among the states. And this created great financial hardships. It made it very difficult to do business. So they decided, basically, they had one particular problem in terms of arranging the commerce among the states. And they decided, with congressional authorization, to hold a special convention in Annapolis, Maryland. But its only purpose was going to be to try to work out better commercial relationships among the states. And as soon as five state delegations got there to Annapolis before the rest even arrived, they decided at the Annapolis convention, you know what? We have deeper problems than just commerce. We've got to redo this whole government. So they then went back and asked for another convention, not in Annapolis, but in the biggest city in the country at the time, in Philadelphia, where the Congress had drawn up the Declaration of Independence. They called another convention and asked all the states to send delegates to that convention for a general revision of the Articles of Confederation to fix all of the things that needed fixing. And no one was quite sure what direction they were going to take. One thing that was sure was one state, a very, very obnoxious one, at least it was considered at the time, was the state that came to be known as Rogue Island. During this entire period, from about 1786 until 1790, Rhode Island was known as Rogue Island because they just wouldn't cooperate. They didn't send anybody to the Constitutional Convention. After the Constitution was ratified and the new government was created, Rhode Island said no. They were going to go their own way, but eventually they were forced to comply. But meanwhile, the other 12 states did agree to send some delegates. And basically, they sent the delegates with the only assignment was to revise the basic provisions of the Articles of Confederation. Now, this became urgent because right at the time that they were trying to get the delegates to come down, there was a major rebellion in western Massachusetts. What was it about? It was about a bunch of subsistence farmers and veterans of the Revolutionary War who had begun shutting down local courts to stop foreclosure proceedings. They were in the midst of a recession, and there were attempts to collect debts and taxes by taking away people's land and their only source of livelihood. So eventually, a former captain, a son of Irish immigrants, he was wounded. He had been a captain in the militia. He had fought 5 years with General Washington in the Revolution. He led a revolution. He got 1,500 men to work with him. And they had determined that they were going to, quote, bring down the tyrannical government, not of Britain this time, but of Massachusetts. The three major bands of rebels from all over western Massachusetts converged on Springfield to grab an armory, to grab weapons. And there, before they were got together in Springfield, there was a very lucky break, which is a message among these different groups of rebels was intercepted by the official troops from the Massachusetts militia who were guarding the armory. So they never did get together. They were fired upon separately. This became a very bloody, serious revolution. And the resistance involved four Shaysites who were killed in Springfield. There were 20 others wounded. Eventually, there were 4,000 participants in what was called Shays Rebellion who had to sign confessions and got amnesty in return. This shocked people in every other colony, not just in Massachusetts. George Washington was so shocked that he decided he would participate in the Constitutional Convention, which was key. George Mason of Virginia said the eyes of the United States are turned upon this assembly concerning the new Constitutional Convention and the expectations raised to a very anxious degree. May God grant that we may be able to gratify them by establishing a wise and just government. The revolt from Great Britain and the formation of our new government at that time were nothing compared to that great business now before us. To view, through the calm, sedate medium of reason, the influence which the establishment now proposed may have upon the happiness or misery of millions yet unborn, is an object of such magnitude as absorbs and in a measure suspends the operation of the human understanding. More on the miracle of the Constitution coming up.
This is the Michael Medved Show.
Like most people, getting in to see the doctor is more difficult than ever before. MyDiscountHealth.com gives you access to a doctor 365 days a year. That's why they created MyDiscountHealth.com with plans to save you time and money. Buy your plan today at MyDiscountHealth.com. What you're hearing right now is the President's March. It was written in 1793 to honor our first president, George Washington, by a German immigrant, and it served for many years as our unofficial national anthem. But right now, we're not in 1793, we're back in 1787 in the summer before there ever was a president of the United States or any form of national executive. There are delegates gathering at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, recognizing that the Articles of Confederation, this loose linking of the states, was terribly ineffective. One of the things that persuaded George Washington himself to go down to Philadelphia, actually up to Philadelphia, because he's coming from his home in Mount Vernon, Virginia. One of the things that persuaded him to make that 150-mile trip to Philadelphia in a special coach and to sit there as president of the convention to preside over the proceedings and the deliberations was Shays' Rebellion. This bloody fight in Massachusetts that scared the dickens out of people throughout the colonies. Washington wrote to his friend Henry Lee just before he left for Philadelphia. He said, "Good God, I am mortified beyond expression when I view the clouds that have spread over the brightest morn that ever dawned in any country. What a triumph for our enemies," he wrote, "to verify their predictions. What a triumph for the advocates of despotism to find that we are incapable of governing ourselves and that systems founded on the basis of equal liberty are merely ideal and fallacious." And then later he wrote to his friend Lafayette back in France, "These disorders are evident marks of a defective government. Indeed, the thinking part of the people of this country are now so well satisfied of this fact that most of the legislatures have appointed, and the rest, it is said, will appoint delegates to meet at Philadelphia the second Monday in May, the next general convention, in general convention of the states to revise and correct the defects of the federal system." Well, ultimately, 12 of the 13 states did send delegates, though they arrived somewhat late. The two first delegations to arrive were Pennsylvania. Obviously, it was the convention was being held in Philadelphia, so that was easy. And then Virginia, which was the most powerful, the most important delegation and included General Washington. Washington took up residence as a house guest of one of the Pennsylvania delegates, Robert Morris, who was the richest man in the colonies, the most successful banker and financier. And the Morris Mansion was considered to be one of the most gracious homes on the continent. It was said to rival anything in London. And the other convenience was Washington could walk. He could stroll over to the State House in Philadelphia. It was the State House for the state of Pennsylvania. Today it's known as Independence Hall. The building still stands. And they were meeting very deliberately in the same room where they had signed the Declaration of Independence back in 1776, some 11 years before. So also within easy walking distance of where Washington was staying was another landmark in Philadelphia, the home of 81-year-old Benjamin Franklin. He was the other world-famous figure besides Washington who was there. And while they were waiting for the other delegations to arrive, Franklin decided, "I'm going to have a big blowout dinner for all of these Virginia delegates." He was a great admirer of Washington, as everyone was at the time. So he invited all of those who had showed up to Philadelphia to this big dinner at his home. And those delegates were almost entirely from either Pennsylvania or Virginia. They were very surprised, however, when their host replaced the sweet wine that was customarily served on such occasions with porter. Porter is a strong, dark, hearty, very alcoholic English beer. Later, Franklin happily reported to the brewer in London that he had bought the beer from that when the cask was broached, the company agreed unanimously that it was the best porter they had ever tasted. Philadelphia is hot and humid in the summer. Was then, still is. They drank a lot. Part of the miracle of the Constitutional Convention is that with all of this drinking, they managed to achieve some pretty memorable work. Here's something that's pretty amazing. Later on in the heat of the summer, there was another dinner for 12 delegates, and the account book showed that those 12 delegates drained 60 full bottles of sweet Madeira wine. This led, well, it didn't lead to immediate agreement, but the dinner at Franklin's house led to a little bit of a conspiracy between the Virginia delegates and the Pennsylvania delegates about their plan for hijacking the convention. How'd that work out? We'll continue that story in this special broadcast, The Miracle of the Constitution.
All across America, this is The Michael Medved Show.
You're listening to a very special broadcast of The Michael Medved Show, The Miracle of the Constitution. And the Constitutional Convention delegates from Virginia and Pennsylvania had just enjoyed a very merry evening at the home of Dr. Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was one of the most famous people in the world. In fact, there are some people who say he was the most famous single citizen of the world at the time. He was known as an inventor. The lightning rod had changed everything. The Franklin stove was a bestseller. Bifocals, which Ben Franklin had invented, were used all around the world. He was known as a publisher, as an author, as the author of aphorisms, early to bed, early to rise, make a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. And Ben Franklin tried to illustrate that provision. He was also known as a diplomat. He was the one who had helped to negotiate French participation, helping America in the Revolution, which allowed us to win. So it was considered a great honor to have lots and lots of porter beer, which they did, and they enjoyed enormously when the Pennsylvania and Virginia delegations met at Ben Franklin's house. But the business that they were up to was figuring out how to direct the Constitutional Convention. And that night, they had determined that we're going to do more than just revise the Articles of Confederation. We need a whole new scheme of government. And fortunately, one of the Virginians, James Madison, who was tiny, he was, depending on the sources you believe, he was somewhere between 5'4 and 5'6. He was always very frail. He never weighed more than 100 pounds. A very slight, scholarly gentleman, but he had laid out a whole scheme of government, which is why we call him the father of the Constitution. And this was codified in the Virginia Plan. So in one of the very, very early meetings of the Constitution, Edmund Randolph, who was the then governor of Virginia, he was dashing. He was in his early 30s. He was considered very handsome and a Revolutionary War hero. And he stood up and he delivered the Virginia Plan. And the Virginia Plan called for some things that we would recognize. The ineffective Congress of the Articles of Confederation, where they needed 9 votes to achieve anything of the 13, and they didn't often get a quorum, and each state had only 1 vote, that was scrapped. There would now be 2 houses of Congress. There'd be a People's House, a House of Representatives, where the members would serve 3 years each, and then that House of Representatives would elect an upper house, a Senate. But they'd do that based upon nominations submitted by state legislatures. And Congress could be overruled by a combination of the president overruling Congress together with a judicial council of the judiciary. Most important to the Virginia Plan and most radical, and something that was an item of hot debate at the Constitutional Convention, the Virginia Plan gave the new federal government the right to strike down any state laws that they didn't like, which really put an end to the idea of sovereign states. Now, why did Virginia do that? One of the things that Virginia cared about was having power requisite to Virginia's dominant position in terms of population, in terms of the size of the state. At the time, of course, Virginia included what later became the separate state of West Virginia, and it was by far the most influential state. What was the second most populous and influential? Pennsylvania. So this axis of Virginia and Pennsylvania, later when the delegates arrived, the delegates of Massachusetts and other big states joined with them, the big states wanted the idea of having both a lower house and an upper house, both of which would be apportioned based on population. And they would then have a very, very powerful new federal government. But none of this was going to be so easy to sell to the delegates of the other states. And they needed to do that to have any chance of success with the Constitutional Convention. Here is the fact that allowed them to do that were two decisions that they made very early on at the beginning of the Constitutional Convention. One of those decisions was to keep it secret. Now, why was that so important? Well, because, as you can imagine, we had just gone through a revolution. People all over the colonies, and particularly in Philadelphia — Philadelphia was amazing. It was a city of 50,000 at the time, by far the biggest in then the United States. But it had, for 50,000 people, 12 newspapers. And all the newspapers want to find out what's happening. And what they did, despite the fact that it's hot in Philadelphia in the summertime and they had no air conditioning, they closed the shutters and drapes in Independence Hall in the Pennsylvania State House so no one could look in, no one could listen in. The deliberations would be entirely secret. And without that secrecy, it's extremely likely that these politicians who were gathering in Philadelphia and arriving gradually there, they would have had no success. The other was a decision that was made by General Washington. And Washington, of course, was considered beyond reproach. He was a great hero. There's a terrific story that's told about Benjamin West, who was a famous painter of the era. He was an American who had gone over to England, where he had a great success. And he painted King George III at one point. And at the very end of the Revolution, they're walking in the garden, the painter Benjamin West, the American, and King George III. And George III asked Benjamin West, "What do you hear of your fellow citizens back in the colonies, former colonies?" And he said, "Well, General Washington has left the army and he's going home to farm in Virginia." And King George said, "He's not becoming a monarch?" And no. And King George said, "Then he will be the greatest man in the world." And Washington, only reluctantly coming back to preside over the Constitutional Convention, had great prestige, and he made the decision that every different item would be debated and voted on separately. In other words, some of the Virginians initially wanted to, "We have the Virginia plan, let's put our whole plan up to a vote, see how it goes." Washington knew it would be voted down. It was too sweeping. It had too many controversial elements. So every single point of change, every single point of arranging the government would be voted separately and would be voted only after very, very spirited debate. Now, the Constitutional Convention came very close to breaking up at several points because there was one issue above all others that passionately divided people, that threatened their deliberations. What was that issue? No, it wasn't slavery, though there were hot debates about that, of course. We'll tell you what that one crucial divisive issue was in the continuing amazing story, The Miracle of the Constitution.
The Michael Medved Show. Michael Medved Show.
This special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show will be available in its entirety from the Medved History Store. That's medvedhistorystore.com. The subject, the miracle of the Constitution. Yes, they were divided over slavery at the Constitutional Convention. A number of our founding fathers were profoundly anti-slavery. That was true of John Adams, who wasn't at the Constitutional Convention. He was away in England serving as our minister to London. It was certainly true of Dr. Franklin. It was true of Alexander Hamilton, who was very much part of the convention. And the fact is that one of the anti-slavery leaders was a slave owner who had come to feel guilty about owning 200 slaves. His name was George Mason of Virginia. And he wanted the Constitution to ban the further slave trade. He eventually agreed to a compromise. The compromise held to it that up until 1808, Congress couldn't eliminate the slave trade. But in 1808, 20 years after the Constitution was adopted, they could. And everyone expected that they would. And they, in fact, did eliminate the importation of new slaves. The The other issue about slavery was, how do you count slaves when you're apportioning members of the House of Representatives or members of Congress? Remember, Virginia wanted the Senate to also be apportioned by population. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts said, look, since the South considers slaves property, there's no more reason to count them for tax purposes or for apportionment purposes than there is to count horses or dogs. Now, it sounds terrible, but you understand why the North would not want all of the slaves who were owned by the South to give them more power. That's how they eventually came to this three-fifths compromise, which was so embarrassing and awful, that for the purposes of apportionment and for the purpose of taxation, a slave would be counted as a person, but only three-fifths of a person. And part of the reason, the argument of that, was that the Virginia in particular wanted wealth, which was counted in terms of the number of slaves you owned, to also be part of how much you were represented. They were able to compromise on the slavery-related issues. What was very difficult for them to compromise on was whether the small states would be protected. The small states, led by New Jersey and Georgia and Connecticut to some extent and some of the others, did not want a situation that Virginia wanted, where Congress would be entirely apportioned by population. Then everything would be dominated by Virginia and Pennsylvania and Massachusetts. This threatened to break apart the whole thing. And it took some miraculous occurrences for this group to stay together and to actually draft a constitution that has worked remarkably well over the years. We will continue this story and tell you about some of the indelible personalities and events that shaped the miracle of the Constitution, which in turn has shaped this greatest nation on God's green earth.
America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And one of the things that makes this such a great nation was a great, big, huge surprise that emerged out of Philadelphia in the very hot, sweltering, humid summer of 1787. What big surprise? Generally, human experience teaches that when a committee tries to invent something, it very rarely turns into a masterpiece. But there's a committee of people. They're all people with substantial egos. They are successful, some of them very successful, some of them world famous, some of them brilliant, some of them not so brilliant. There are 55 people who were called together at one point or another to participate in a constitutional convention to invent an entirely new scheme of government for a new nation, the United States of America. 11 years after declaring independence, all of a sudden the Articles of Confederation that had bound the nation together up till that point weren't working anymore. So they came together to change everything. And the result, out of lots of conflict and lots of compromise, was a masterpiece. That is what constituted the miracle of the Constitution. In this very special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, we cover the miracle of the Constitution, following as best we can the debates, the conflicts, the close calls, the amazing providential protection that appears to have led to a charter of government that has worked remarkably well for the United States of America. We had 12 of the states all participating, all debating, and in a very spirited way, some very fundamental changes. One of the changes that was most important that the delegates all knew they had to make was to create a federal executive. What was amazing about the Articles of Confederation is there was no executive. People were allergic to the idea of a king. That hadn't worked out so well, they thought, in terms of what was going on back in Britain. So they tried during the Articles of Confederation basically just to have Congress leading the whole way. One House of Congress, the Confederation Congress. Well, now they had to set up an executive. But there were some people who were very afraid that if you had one executive, it would be too much power in the hands of one individual. So they talked about having two, or some people even three, presidents, with the idea that if those presidents were fighting against each other, it would curb their power. It would avoid having some kind of overwhelming power concentrated in the hands of one individual. The folks who argued for one president and only one pointed to the guy sitting in the front of the room. He was on a little raised platform behind a little desk. He said almost nothing during most of the meetings of the Constitutional Convention. His name was Washington. He was from Mount Vernon, Virginia. And he was the most admired man by far, along with Dr. Franklin, who was also there. He was the most admired man by far in the 13 states and the 12 states represented there at the convention. The point being that folks trusted George Washington. They knew that he was going to be the first president. And so they agreed when they voted, okay, we're going to have only one president. Another hot issue that divided the delegates, aside from the issues of slavery, which we've talked about a little bit, another hot issue was whether or not people would get paid for serving in Congress. A number of individuals felt, wait a minute, we shouldn't be paying people. Otherwise, what will happen is Congress will vote increases in its own salary. They'll vote more and more and more. And people will want to come to Congress in order to get rich. But the other side argued that, wait, if we pay nothing to people, then that will limit service in Congress to people who are independently wealthy already. And it will mean that honest working people will have no chance if they have to pay their own expenses to travel great distances, and travel was difficult at that time. So they voted after a spirited debate. Yes, they were going to be able to pay members of Congress. There was one issue that they simply couldn't resolve. And that was the most important issue over which the Constitutional Convention nearly broke up on several occasions. Very, very heated debate. The issue was, how is Congress going to be arranged? The Confederation Congress had only one vote per state, so that the smallest state, Georgia, had the same number of votes as the largest state, Virginia. Each one got only one. And you needed nine votes to get anything done. As a result, almost nothing got done. The big states, led by Virginia with the Virginia Plan, wanted to replace that idea of one vote per state with proportional representation, having each state wield as much power as its percentage of the population. In other words, if a state was twice as big, it would have twice as many members of Congress. Seemed to make sense to them. The small states said, no, that will allow the three big states, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, to absolutely dominate, and it will take away our sovereignty and our right to function. This was a huge issue, and it remained an issue after they had decided we're going to have two different houses of Congress, not one. And then they voted that the lower house, the most representative house, the House of Representatives, that would be apportioned the way Virginia wanted, according to population. But the small states absolutely resisted the idea that the upper house of the legislature, which later came to be called the Senate, would also be apportioned by population. They insisted there should be one senator or just two senators for every individual state. This was going to be necessary. And the arguments raged back and forth. And there were strong points, obviously, made on both sides. James Wilson of Pennsylvania, who, by the way, dominated the debates at the Constitutional Convention. He is one of our crucial founding fathers. He also helped writing the Declaration of Independence. He is almost not remembered today. And partially, he was a Scots immigrant. The end of his life was not a happy one. He died in and out of debtor's prison because he had bad investments in Western lands. He had come from Scotland when he was 21 years old. He was a scholarly guy with thick spectacles and prematurely white hair and pudgy cheeks. He did not have the common touch, but he was brilliant. He spoke on the floor of the convention during the summer of 1787 168 times, more than Madison, more than Franklin, more than Hamilton, more than anyone else. And one of the things he said regarding this, he said, why should a national government be unpopular? Has it less dignity? Will each citizen enjoy under it less liberty or protection? Will a citizen of Delaware be degraded by becoming a citizen of the United States? He resisted the idea that what Congress should be was basically just a federation of states. Congress and the federal government, according to James Wilson's view, should be a superior government with the ability to overrule the states, even in determinations that the states made on the legislative level locally. But this was not at all approved by delegates from, well, for instance, New Jersey. The leader for what was called the New Jersey Plan, which was a plan of having apportionment, one vote per state, was a delegate named Patterson. And William Patterson was an appropriate guy to be an advocate for small states because he was a small guy. He was barely 5'2". And Patterson basically argued that they had not been sent there to abolish state sovereignty. He said, we are met here as the deputies of 13 independent sovereign states for federal purposes. Can we consolidate their sovereignty and form one nation and annihilate the sovereignties of our states who have sent us here for other purposes? The people of America are sharp-sighted, said William Patterson. And not to be deceived, the idea of a national government as contradistinguished from a federal one never entered into the mind of any of them. To which Caledonia James, that was the nickname they gave James Wilson because of his thick Scottish burr, he said, can we forget for whom we are forming a government? Is it for men or for the imaginary beings called states? Are not the citizens of Pennsylvania equal to those of New Jersey? Does it require 150 of the former to balance 50 of the latter? He said, if the small states will not confederate on this plan, Pennsylvania, and I presume some other states, will not confederate on any other. They were willing to break apart the Union over this issue. How is it resolved? And how did more of a spirit of compromise and cooperation take hold at the convention? Well, it involved, in part, a number of factors. One of them, the 4th of July. The other, a religious plea from a very old man. And the other, the weather. We'll tell you all about that with the continued story of the miracle of the Constitution. You're listening to a special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, the story of the miracle of the Constitution, which is an account of how it is that a bunch of squabbling, sometimes bitterly bickering delegates came together in Philadelphia in a steamy, humid, difficult summer of 1787, where they were bothered enormously by bugs. Apparently, Philadelphia at the time had large and horrible mosquitoes, and the only way to keep them out, because they hadn't really invented screens at the time, was basically to keep the windows closed. And they kept the windows at Independence Hall, what was called then the State House in Philadelphia. They kept the windows closed and the drapes and the shutters. Why? Because the proceedings of the convention were secret. They didn't want the press, any of the 12 newspapers that were functioning in Philadelphia at the time, to find out what they were debating about. They certainly didn't want people to know how close they were to breaking apart the entire convention. William Patterson of New Jersey, putting forward the New Jersey plan, which was basically we apportion Congress, basically all of it should be apportioned, one vote per state, no state having an advantage by population. James Wilson of Pennsylvania and James Madison of Virginia and Edmund Randolph of Virginia all fighting for the Virginia plan, which was the apportionment should be by population. So what do you do? The obvious step was, since you have two houses of Congress, was what was called the Connecticut plan. Old Roger Sherman, who next to Benjamin Franklin was the oldest member of the convention, he had written helped to write the Articles of Confederation. He had been there for the Declaration of Independence. Now he was there for the Constitution. He basically, even though he represented a small state, said, look, we've got to get together on this. We've got two houses of Congress. Let's split the difference. You do one house with a one vote per state or two votes per state, the same number of votes per state, and you do the other house based on population. But at this point, the two sides were both too passionately invested in their own arguments for apportionment to consider the Connecticut Compromise. So they said, oh, very nice, old man, Roger Sherman, you've made the suggestion. And they went on to their arguments. The core argument was this. Was this going to be a national government or a federal government? Were the members of Congress going to represent states, or were they going to represent voters in the states in their function as citizens of a federal government? James Wilson, in particular, argued passionately that he was not a citizen of Pennsylvania. He was a resident of Pennsylvania. He was a citizen of the United States. This was very, very controversial. And things took a turn for the worst when one member of the convention, who was a notorious drunk, and when I say notorious drunk, I mean brawls, showing up to sessions drunk. He was also a brilliant lawyer. His name was Luther Martin. He was a delegate from Maryland, a small state. And Luther Martin got up and gave a 3-hour harangue. And it was early in the morning, and he was already, as they say, three sheets to the wind, apparently. It was apparently the most unpleasant speech of the whole convention because he was very angry. He was very incoherent. He was very soused. And then he said chilling words as they were getting ready to adjourn, which is, I haven't been able to finish. I'll grab the floor tomorrow when we resume. This speech enraged a lot of the big state delegates because he was accusing them of all sorts of bad will. And they began to think, well, maybe it wouldn't be so terrible if Virginia and Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, all representing three different regions of the country, if those three big states went their own way with a majority of the population in the 13 states and leave the other states to fend for themselves. Well, sensing that contempt, Gunning Bedford of Delaware, who was one of the least vocal and least known of all the delegates. He was a one-time Princeton classmate of James Madison, the scholarly, diminutive, frail little Virginian who was in many ways the intellectual father of what became the Constitution. Gunning Bedford of Delaware stood up, and then he electrified the session. Why? Because he said this. He said he accused the big states of bad faith. He said, they insist they never will hurt or injure the lesser states. I do not, gentlemen, trust you. And when he said he didn't trust the big states, people were shocked. There were boos and murmurs. He said, where is your plighted faith? Will you crush the smaller states? If those threatened states form their own confederation, the fault will be yours. And all the nations of the earth will justify us. The large states dare not dissolve the confederation. If they do, the small ones will find some foreign ally of more honor and good faith to take them by the hand and do them justice. I say this not to threaten or intimidate. If we once leave this floor and solemnly renounce your new project, what will be the consequence? You will annihilate your federal government and ruin must stare you in the face. There were people who stood up, were walking to the doors. They were horrified. The convention was very close to breaking up. There was serious talk of people leaving the convention, going home, whole state delegations deserting. In fact, in New York, the state delegation was so upset with the way that things were going toward a strong federal government, a strong central government, that of the three delegates from New York, two of them went home. They walked out. They wanted none of this Constitution. The only one who stayed was named Alexander Hamilton, and he played an important role in the convention. At this point, there were factors that began to prevail to cool down the events. On June 28th, Dr. Franklin, the most respected member of the convention next to Washington, decided to speak. Now, most of the time when he spoke, his legs were unsteady. He was 81 years old. His voice was thin. He didn't deliver his own speeches. He handed a text to James Wilson, Caledonia James, and James Wilson read it out in his ringing Scots burr. But this time, on June 28th, Dr. Franklin thought it was so important that he apparently delivered the speech himself. James Madison later copied it down based on Franklin's own text. Here's what Dr. Franklin said. He said, "The small progress we have made and the melancholy proof of the imperfection of human understanding are shown by that progress. In this situation of this assembly, groping as it were in the dark to find political truth and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of lights," meaning God, of course, "to illuminate our understandings? In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for the divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. To that kind providence, we owe this happy opportunity of consulting in peace on the means of establishing our future national felicity. And we have now forgotten that powerful friend? How did they remember that powerful friend?" Coming up in the continuing story of the miracle of the Constitution. You're listening to the music of William Billings, who was a composer in Boston at the time of the American Revolution. He wrote that church hymn, a Chester, which was later adopted as the marching song of the Continental Army for the American Revolution. And Chester, of course, had frequent references to God and God's protection. The end of the first verse is "New England's God forever reigns." And that was a message that Benjamin Franklin tried to deliver to the Constitutional Convention. That's the subject of this very special broadcast of the Medved Show, The Miracle of the Constitution. With the delegates at each other's throats, with the small states ready to walk out, unable to decide how Congress should be arranged and apportioned, Benjamin Franklin stood up and gave one of the most dramatic speeches of the convention. It was a speech pleading for prayer. And why would that be? Benjamin Franklin was not known to be a deeply pious man. He was very unconventional in his religious ideas. He had a lot of deistic religious ideas. But he understood that belief in God and belief in divine providence, which virtually all of the revolutionary figures of greatness seemed to share, that belief helped put disputes like the disputes that they were undergoing at the convention into perspective. He concluded his remarks at the convention by saying, "I have lived, sir, a long time. And the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings, that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this," said Benjamin Franklin. "And I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. We shall be divided by our little partial local interests. Our projects will be confounded, and we ourselves shall become a reproach and a byword down to future ages. And what is worse, mankind may hereafter, from this unfortunate instance, despair of establishing governments by human wisdom and leave it to chance, war, and conquest. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessings on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business, and that one or more of the clergy of the city be requested to officiate in that service." Now, this was a remarkable moment. And there were many, many members of the convention who were nodding in agreement and feeling moved by what Dr. Franklin had said. Dr. Franklin, by the way, was so infirm at this time that he couldn't walk the few blocks from his home in Philadelphia to Independence Hall, the State House, where the convention was being held. He was carried in a sedan chair. And the sedan chair was not carried by slaves. Dr. Franklin was very, very anti-slavery. It was carried by prisoners. He had helped to start an experimental penal institution, a prison, whereby they rehabilitated the prisoners by having them work. And there were four of the prisoners who worked by carrying Dr. Franklin to the Constitutional Convention and around the city of Philadelphia on a sedan chair. Everyone respected him. Everyone loved him. No one wanted to approve his resolution. Why not? Because they weren't religious? No. Because they were broke. There was no money in the Constitutional Convention to go ahead and provide for paying ministers. There was also an objection that was raised by Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton said that if they suddenly started calling ministers in, people would know that they were close to breaking up, and the newspapers would get wind of it, and rumor would run rampant. And so there was a decision. It was actually suggested by Edmund Randolph. Rather than having prayers every day, he suggested that there be a special sermon that they would all attend, and George Washington led the way, on the 4th of July, which was coming up in just 6 days. They would celebrate the 4th of July, they would hear a sermon about God's will, and then, one hoped, they would come back and be able to work out this fundamental disagreement that threatened to split the big states from the small states and to shatter the Union. So how did it work out? Well, before they had a chance to hear that sermon, before they had a chance to celebrate the 4th of July, the 11th anniversary of independence, there was a crucial vote that looked like it was going to go wrong and lead once and for all to the breakup of attempts to form a new government under the Constitution. What happened? An inexplicable stroll saved the day. We'll tell you how that worked out and more with a special broadcast, The Miracle of the Constitution. Special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, The Miracle of the Constitution. And this broadcast is partially inspired by a wonderful book from literally more than 50 years ago. It's a book by an author named Catherine Drinker Bowen, who wrote a book called A Miracle in Philadelphia. And partially, the material here that I'm presenting is taken from her book, which is in turn taken from the notes of the Constitutional Convention, the copious notes that were written down by James Madison, who kept records of everything. And Catherine Drinker Bowen notes that Benjamin Franklin's beautiful speech, his intervention to beg for prayer, a plea, by the way, that was not heeded. Yes, they were going to go hear a sermon on the 4th of July, but they didn't have the money to pay for daily prayer. That Franklin's intervention succeeded in calling an assembly of doubting minds to a realization that destiny herself sat as guest and witness in this room. He reminded the delegates that in the same room they had written and approved the Declaration of Independence that had started this country 11 years before. Now they were engaged in the very, very serious business of trying to structure a new government that would work better for this nation. And they saw the whole world looking upon them as an example and a possible inspiration for how people could govern themselves. The problem is that as they reassembled, they took up breaks every Sunday because most of the delegates were religious people. And they reassembled on Monday morning, July 2nd, right before the 4th of July. And they were finally going to vote on a proposal by the small states, led by Connecticut and New Jersey, that the Senate, the upper house, would grant two votes for every state. No state would have more votes based upon bigger population or greater wealth. The the big states, led by James Madison of Virginia and Edmund Randolph of Virginia and James Wilson of Pennsylvania, were confident that they had the vote with some of their cooperation that they received from some other small states to block this from going through. Basically, they were very confident, and they were ready to vote it down. If they voted it down, the small states, led by Delaware and New Jersey and delegates from Maryland, the small states were going to walk out, and it would have been an ugly situation. All of it came down to one man, a mysterious figure who, together with Roger Sherman of Connecticut and Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania, was one of the wise old men of the convention. At age 64, a lifelong bachelor named Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer ended up deciding the fate of the United States. Now, who was this guy? We don't know that much about him. There are two big mysteries about him. One is, where did he get that aristocratic-sounding middle name of St. Thomas Jennifer? He was referred to as Daniel Jennifer, but really he signed his name on the Constitution as Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer. He was a wealthy man. He owned an 800-acre plantation. Lifelong bachelor. He left the plantation to a distant relative. He left his famous library. He had a huge library to his close friend, James Madison. And in his will, he also arranged to free his remaining 22 slaves within 6 years of his death, which was 3 years after the Constitution was drafted. But here was the story. Because of his friendship with Madison, Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer was a strong government, a pro-big states guy. He wanted everything distributed, not one vote per state, but everything apportioned and people becoming citizens of the United States, of a federal government, not just citizens of a state, and the states would come together in a federation. So he traditionally had always voted with the big states. The problem was he recognized that if he voted that way, there were two delegates from Maryland. There was Luther Martin, the drunk, who was going to vote against any big state federal plan that would concentrate power in the national government. That if Luther Martin voted his way and he voted his way, then Maryland's vote would be canceled. That's the way they did it. If there were only two delegates and there were only two Maryland delegates left, Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer and Luther Martin, they would cancel each other out, and the mission, the move to actually apportion the Senate the way it ended up being apportioned, that would be defeated. So something extraordinary happened, and no one at the time could explain it. Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer had been one of the most reliable, one of the most genial delegates. He was a very elegant guy. He loved fancy clothes and fine wines and basically was friendly with everybody. And he was also there for every important vote. But all of a sudden, this most important vote of the convention, where James Madison is pushing, now we're going to apportion the Senate the same way we do the House. All of a sudden, he got up before the vote and left the room. No one knows where he went. He went out into the street and didn't come back for a half hour until the vote was over. And because he was gone, Luther Martin cast the vote for Maryland. And the vote for Maryland was yes for this plan of apportioning the Senate so each state got its separate vote. People were angry. James Wilson and the other people were pushing for the other side. And Daniel of St. Martin Jennifer comes back in. He had basically taken a fall for the team. He understood that his point of view had to lose in this vote to keep the convention together. His inexplicable stroll and missing a crucial vote saved the convention. What happened was there was a tie vote. It was 5-5 of the states that had enough votes to be decided. And right after that tie vote, there was a move by General Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina to appoint a committee to resolve this, which basically meant they were going to go for the Connecticut Compromise. And everybody was swept up because of this tie with the move, okay, we have to placate the small states. And then they voted, they appointed the committee. The committee included Dr. Franklin, the committee included someone, Abraham Baldwin from Georgia, who was in favor of that compromise. And then they were going to move to the 4th of July. Because the 4th of July, they were all going to take time off. How did the 4th of July help to further save the convention? We will get to that aspect of the story, the miracle of the Constitution, coming right up. It's 6 a.m. It's July 4th, a sultry summer day, as usual, in Philadelphia, and it's 1787. And at 6 a.m., the city's militia fires its first celebratory blast into the air, waking everyone up. And then the artillery came, using all available field pieces to deliver 3 times 13 rounds of booming cannon fire. That was met as a triple huzzah to honor all 13 states of the Union. The celebrations in the town for the 4th of July were extraordinary and lavish, and people were happy because they knew that a constitutional convention was going on. They knew nothing about the fact that it had come within moments of breaking up, had come within one stroll of actually breaking apart. And all of a sudden, the delegates came together, led by George Washington, to the Reformed Calvinist Church to hear a sermon, as had been promised by Edmund Randolph at the convention. And the patriotic orator was James Campbell, who said, "Methinks I already see the stately fabric of a free and vigorous government rising out of the wisdom of the federal convention." And that night, there was heavy drinking, as there almost always was at that era in the American Republic. And in Philadelphia, they had toasts, one typical toast to the federal convention. "May the result of their meeting be as glorious as its members are illustrious." Across the river in New Jersey, they toasted the Grand Convention. "May they form a constitution for an eternal republic." The delegates came back after the 4th of July, and they had a huge demonstration of fireworks that night in Philadelphia. And they were determined to work everything out. They put into place the Connecticut Compromise. Yes, we would have a Senate where each state would have the same number of votes, giving great power, disproportionate power, to the small states. And yes, we'd have a House of Representatives where the big states would dominate. And part of what changed was the weather. The delegates came back and they voted final approval to the committee's solution to their most intractable dilemma. Catherine Drinker Bowen speculates that perhaps the delegates never would have reached agreement had not the heat broken. The weather changed. God cooperated, heard the prayers of Benjamin Franklin and others. There were fewer complaints about the heat and how difficult it was. And for the remaining weeks of the Constitutional Convention, they were determined to work everything out. But they still had a huge fight before them. The fight to win ratification of this new constitution. They had to take it back to the states and get the states to agree. How was that fight won? How was that achievement accomplished? That is part of the story. An amazing and ultimately inspiring story, the miracle of the Constitution. We'll continue that tale as a part of the tribute to the founding charter of this greatest nation on God's green earth.